Attention Crossrim shoppers. The store is now closed. If you were unable to make your final purchases and grab a Crossrim, Deep Peaks, or Hug a Reitman shirt, we've got you covered. Just drop us a direct message and a representative from our staff will be happy to accommodate your needs. Thank you for shopping the Paranormal Shop and have a nice afterlife.
Hey there, everybody, and welcome to the Crossrip. It's week two of our Frozen Empire discussion. Week two of who knows how many. Yeah, this week we're going to be talking a little bit more about Melody. We're going to be talking about the Back in Town issue number one and how it connects to the film. We're also going to be talking a little bit about music and our favorite parts, maybe a few things that we wish we would have seen in the film. It's a really in-depth discussion. Stay tuned. Here we go.
Still Playing With Toys presents the Ghostbusters Interdimensional Crossrip, the biggest podcast since 1909.
So great!
News, interviews, and commentary on everything Ghostbusters.
Are you the key master?
Here are your hosts, Troy Benjamin and Chris Stewart.
Weird name. Gotta make the best of that.
You know, it's just occurred to me, we really haven't had a completely successful test of this equipment.
I was just reading the Hollywood Reporter when you
logged in. What do we have?
The interview with Emily Allen.
Emily Allen Lynn. Yeah.
even the Hollywood Reporter is clickbaity these days. Ghostbusters star explains why her Frozen Empire character was kept secret. And then the first one, it's like, duh, because she was a ghost. And they didn't want to tell anyone. It's like,
exactly.
We kind of guessed that one.
Yeah, it's a nice little read.
Actually, the best one was the one where they it says that Jason and Gil opted for her to not float around because it makes her more relatable and human. And I'm like, yeah, and cuts $250,000 worth of effects. Out of
the, you don't have to have a wire rig following her around everywhere she goes.
But, you know, sure, it's the humanizing effect. That's a good story. Maybe I'm cynical, but that was for the normal people. Between the lines.
Did the article say anything about when she passed away? That was something that you talked about, and it has become the hot button topic on all of the message boards and Reddit threads and Discord channels. Is like,
I don't read them. Did I cause it? Because that kind of
I think it's become the natural conversation as to, you know, when exactly do we think that Melody passed away? And you sort of surmised in the last episode, you said the 80s, and I was like, really? Because I kind of got like a longer. And then Emily.
Well, here's the thing. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, Emily on her Instagram put some concept art that she's wearing like turn of the century, like early 1900s clothes, which...
That's exactly what I was about to mention, is I saw that exact same thing. The trouble is that, well, we'd have to see more from the costume designer, because it didn't feel I don't recall a lot of the lace gloves in that time period, but it's not impossible. So yeah, I walked away with kind of a material girl kind of vibe. But in retrospect, so here's the thing. By the time you add the fire effects and all that, and that weird you know how the ghosts have almost like they're obeying their own light rules to a degree.
Yeah, that sort of transparency with like a little glow kind of thing.
Yeah, you don't get a good look at what she's wearing. So that's not to say costume designers didn't put a lot of thought into it and didn't have a time and a place. It's just, it's now very hard to tell unless somebody stands up and says, it was this era. I hadn't actually finished the article, so I don't know.
Well, and the other thing too that hey everybody, welcome to the Crossword, welcome to our Frozen Empire part two chat. We're just diving into it, obviously.
part two slash question mark.
However many, the other thing too is she sort of has her own set of logic and rules as a ghost. You know, it doesn't seem like she is a repeater, that she's stuck in anchored to one place. She does have her object, of course, that she's sort of anchored to, and that's her unfinished business. But so my other thought was like, she could have died in the early aughts or the 20s. Like, it could, she could have been a Depression era a teenager, but she is changing. She's evolving. She is changing her appearance because ghosts can do that. We have learned from Afterlife that Egon can show up in his flight suit if he wants to. So, you know, maybe she did die in the early 1900s, but has adopted the vernacular of the modern era, has adopted some material girl clothes because she adores the hell out of Madonna. She could be doing all of these things, and that's just... because what I keep coming to back to is that she's so good at chess, and she even makes a point of saying, I've had a lot of time to practice. So it's like, that to me is more than 40 or 50 years. Like, that we're talking like she's probably had 100 years of spooking people in the park, you know?
I'm prepared to walk it back, my 80s thing, a little bit now that I've seen that art and all that. It's pretty... and then that word use. Because remember, we talked about that before, the use of the word tenement is kind of an older thing, even though they weren't exactly gone by the 80s. Like, maybe not.
But then do you keep it ambiguous, too, so that Phoebe is attracted to her? Because if she is a Victorian-era teenager, she's going to speak a lot. Her diction will be completely different. She'll be speaking old English. Yeah, you know, it's
old English from the turn of the last century.
Well, you know what I mean, but because the film starts with the 1907 flashback. You know, maybe it makes her a more relatable character to Phoebe if she is not of that time period, if she is not of that era, or you know.
Yeah. Well, if you're advocating that I should stick to my 80s one just because it makes the character more relatable to Phoebe, I'm down with that, too.
I liked your reasoning that it was like saying goodbye to the 80s, that this was like, all right, we're moving forward. Yeah.
The thing that doesn't fit into the turn of the 20th century or the start of the 20th century thing is the diner.
Because
I don't think that style of diner goes... Unless, again, it's one of those things that maybe it was an older diner and then they upgraded style-wise in the 50s. I don't, but at that point, you're like reading between lines of lines of lines to try to get where you're going. So I don't know. I do kind of like thinking that she was in the 80s. It does make her a more modern speaker. You know, the clothing is not wildly out of place or inappropriate for that, you know, Material Girl era. And then, the thing fits. You mentioned her relating to Phoebe. That was the other big thing in the article, because I just got to the end. They never really figure out – I can't see anything that talks about the era, but they do get into the whole relationship with Phoebe thing.
Yeah.
Which, predictably, has lit up other parts of the internet. But she drove home the point that I was thinking, which was – you know, there's such a thing as a close, you know, connection, right? Yeah. You don't have to be in love with somebody. You don't have to have a same-sex relationship or anything like that. You can just connect closely with somebody. And that's where she left it at. And I'm like, that makes perfect sense. And more to the point than rather – see, the internet then wants to fight about it. The internet sees it as red flag, blue flag, and then they want to duke it out until it's determined. It's like, or we do like all art and whatever you think is perfectly fine and whatever somebody else thinks is perfectly fine. And
or look at it for what it is too. It's like in Phoebe's case, she is a 16-year-old who does have social anxieties and awkwardness and things like that. Yeah. And, you know, when you're 16, you don't know what it is either. Like, am I in love with this person? Is this just a friendship? Like, you're in a constant state of flux. Like, you somebody looks at you in a manner in the hallway at school, and all of a sudden, you're like, do they like me? Should they like me? Yeah. Should I go talk to like that? I hated that part of being a teenager, and I still hate that part of being a 40-year-old too.
I think what is getting lost in the discussion is the thing that, and it's society has kind of happily stomped this into the ground, even though when you're adults now these days, we're supposed to be a lot more less stuck up about this stuff. Yeah. It's like when you're in in like school and you run into somebody that you're like, that person's really cool, they like the same stuff I do and all that, it gets they continue to make it weird if it's you know, somebody of the same sex and all that. It's like, and they, what they stamp out is the idea that, you know, maybe you can have a friend and just love a friend, and it doesn't have to be anything more than that. Like, and I know as somebody born in the 70s, it took me until I got to like my late 30s where I was comfortable and in another town with a lot of really cool people who, a bunch of them were just sort of like, hey man, how's it going? Talk to you later. Love you, man. And I'm like, yeah, like it doesn't mean anything. Well, other than, yeah, you love them, right?
You That's
it.
Them.
It's perfectly fine. So yeah, she, Melody is a year older than her. She's got a bit of, you know, the social cool that Phoebe doesn't, which would be kind of attractive to her. She's a ghost, and she's got a lot of confusing questions about her grandfather and life and what she does. And the other one is a much better chess player than she is, which must be incredibly infuriating and at the same time compelling to somebody who's her whole life been the smartest kid, you know, person in the room sort of thing.
So, yeah, which we see in Back in Town. Funny enough, that's where we're also going to talk about Back in Town issue number one a little bit here. But yeah, you see that she's the social outcast, the outsider who's the smartest one in the room and does six quadratic equations as opposed to the one example that was asked of her. And
yeah,
you know, I think that that's character building. And especially now that she is older and she's getting to those 16, 17 year old puberty anxieties and things like that. Am I cool? Am I attractive? Am I all of these things that Phoebe probably never worried about. And probably still doesn't, to be honest.
The world needs to hug more, frankly. Let's just get over it. That's it.
With consent. The world needs to hug more with consent.
Sorry. Well, yeah, right. unless you're a Major League Baseball mascot. Consent's a little harder. It's a little bit more implied when you walk through. I don't know where that train of thought's going.
I don't know. That was a good follow-up to...
Do you want to talk about the comic at all?
Let's do that right now. Yeah, let's talk
about
the comic.
Let's just get it out of the way.
Yeah. Back in Town issue number one has been out now for 2 weeks as you've been listening to this.
By the time you listen to this, it'll be... So, yeah, I got that for that Wednesday, read it, and then we recorded it. Oh, no, it was the day of recording.
We got it. Yeah, because you and I had both read it right as we were chatting.
So what I was trying to dial in on is in about 2 weeks, then the issue two. 2 weeks from you listening to this, if you listen when this episode drops, issue two will be out because they're going to drop them monthly.
So how do you want to approach this? I have some sort of general thoughts and then, two words. Okay.
It's all right.
It's all right. It's definitely an issue number one. It's definitely, you know, that they're bridging from Afterlife to Frozen Empire, so you know that it's a bridge story. I'm still having trouble with it. It's an adjustment period because for the longest time, Ghostbusters Comics has been the same creative team now at IDW. You always had the Dapper Dan Schoening art. You always had Eric Burnham doing the words.
Yeah.
So, you know, After a certain amount of time, like you've gotten adjusted and used to that art style and that writing style, and now we have a different. It's almost like when they did the was it Displaced Aggression or which one was the IDW series that had the multiple artists and multiple writers that were working on different issues, which was awesome, but it was just kind of jarring because you would read one and you'd have to then switch into another gear. That was like the learning curve that happened to me, like getting used to Blue's art took a second. And then as soon as I kind of got past that, I was like, because I'll be honest, I had trouble differentiating Trevor and Phoebe at the very beginning just because of the way that he draws them.
It's a much more common and modern style. I don't know if it's been given a name, but I've seen it in a lot of other what's the guy who did hang on one sec here.
There's those it's a very, to me it's always been a very indie style. You know, it's like it's not quite Scott Pilgrim caricature, but it's also somewhere in between caricature and realism, and it's very minimalist, and I dig it. It took a second to, like, you're used to the sort of like hybrid real Ghostbusters animation style that Dan did in the IDW series, where you're looking in the background for all the stuff he's hidden. You know, it's that detailed, where now it's like, look, the characters, the expressions on their faces and the words are really what are mattering here. Which I think bodes well for, it's a family story. This is the family moving into the firehouse, and there's some sort of an entity that feeds on their dysfunction, which I'm guessing it will be eating well based on the stuff that is set up here in the first issue. Did you have that same sort of bump that I had?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you and I talked a bit about this last week, although we didn't, it was off mic, but we got spoiled. We got really spoiled in that a combination of Dan's overdoing it. I don't know how you want to describe it.
Labor intensive?
Labor intensive approach
it
to art.
Yeah, Dan probably burned himself out four times over working on the Ghostbusters book just because he loves it so damn much.
And him and Eric were constantly infusing it with every little side reference they could, which just, again, amplified the work that Dan had to do. And they did it for 6 years, something like that, a long time.
Yeah.
So we got very used to the style. We got very used to a very high density, colorful. That's the other thing, too. This one had a much more muted color approach.
Yeah, that took a little getting used to also. Yeah.
So then you come to this one, and I can't – Ryan Dole, help me out. It was an indie series. I can see it, and I think the artist's name was Paul something, but – about the British guy, but he wasn't, it wasn't the Marvel Captain Britain or something like that. I'll figure it out. We'll stop recording this and I'll snap awake in the middle of the night figuring this one out. But was the example. Was the example that came to mind. There is this very cartoony, is not quite right, but it's a step down from, if you read Scott McCloud's book on Understanding Comics. And he's got that grid of reality. Like, he shows you where, how you can, you know, go from the smiley face down to photorealistic.
Yeah.
And all the steps in between, you know, that's where comic art lives, is at these different settings. And this one is it's not wrong. And this is what I hate about people going, this comic sucks. It's like, nope, the art is great. It is different art.
Yeah, it's just different. It's not.
And it is a very big shock. We haven't seen a new comic in a while, and all the last ones we read were, like I said, the coloring that was done on Dan's stuff was very vibrant. This one had a muted color palette, a much simpler approach, and it felt like too that they kind of wanted to play a bit the same way Dan and Eric did, but it kind of got reduced to one panel where it was like, there's that piece of equipment we recognize and there's that snack we recognize, and then they never kind of attempted it again, whereas we all know that Mr. Tanaka is out there and all that and could write a companion book on panel one, page one, panel four, page one. Like, it was, everything was just jam packed. So what you got to kind of focus on now is and this is what bugs me, is that it's a pretty cool story. Once you get past the different approach in art, and that's the problem with comics, is that being that it's a visual medium, people respond to that first. Once you put that aside and you read it, it's pretty cool, and I'm actually kind of looking forward to where we're going to end up with this thing. So, that's why when my two-word response is, it's all right.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's only the first episode. I want to see where it goes. I recognize the response we've all had to the art, and I absolutely flat out disagree with anybody that dislikes it, because, again, everything's about subjectivity and perspective. Get some.
And is it is it's making it more accessible too. You know, here we're talking about Dan's panels that were jam packed with Easter eggs and things that Michael was, you know, detailing for the wiki. You're trying to build a new audience here. You're trying to bring in younger viewers. You're trying to bring in younger fans. So if you give them an art style that does feel, like you said, more modern, you know, it's not something that's nostalgic or retro, and it's not something that's highly stylized, so that, you know, maybe you're turning off some readers. You know, it's an accessible art style with accessible panels. Like, hey, there's a Twinkie. Hey, there's the Nintendo. That was for, like you said, that's for us, the NES Advantage and the Hammer's Hammer. In the background, that was like our wink and nod, but everything else was for kind of like the uninitiated fans, which I also appreciate, because look,
yeah,
you and I aren't getting any younger. Our listenership out there, you're all looking great. This is not a reflection of you. You are all looking fabulous and youthful and energetic. But yeah, you know, Frozen Empire is bringing in new fans, just the same way that Answer the Call brought in new fans and Afterlife brought in new fans. And
right.
So that's what this is really for. But you're right. The story is fantastic, Chris. Like, I'm excited to see where. Like Trevor and Phoebe are having these growing pains. They make it to the big city, and then they realize, like, it kind of sucks. Like, they're not really into it.
Interesting point you made about accessibility, too, because if you think back to 2016, and oh, my God. We did preface that you and I are a little overtired, right? Help me out here. The last comic company that had the rights. But
88 miles per hour? What?
No, the ones after 88 and before IDW. IDW, thank you. Okay. Oh my God.
I thought you meant before IDW. Yeah, it's like,
No.
Now comics? IDW, we're going that far back? Yeah.
IDW had the rights when Answer the Call came out, and they did. Was it a four-parter or was it? Yeah. They did a small series to tie into the 2016 one. What did they do with that one? They picked an artist, still great. But way less frenetic than and detail packed than Dapper Dan. Dapper Dan was writing comics that were aimed at us, the hardcore fan, and then the 2016 books were aimed at people who were more likely coming out of, I don't know if softer is the word I want to use, but I guess that's one way to look at it, because they also had a less frenetic color palette. The art wasn't as just eyeball blastingly awesome. As again, no, that's a bad way to put it, because it makes it sound like the other art is lesser or something. It's not.
Yeah, it's dark.
It's just Dan and Eric created a comic book that went to 11, and when you're going to do an Answer to the Call book, you kind of wanted to bring it down to like 8. And again, that's not a score; that's just a volume level, so that the average person that came out and said, "I love that movie." You know, with Kate McKinnon and all that, I want to see more about the characters. There's a comic book. I love comic books, and you're not feeling slapped in the face when
sensory overload.
You know what I mean? Like, sensory overload is the best way to put it. So,
So issue two, very exciting. I think we'll be able to have a more robust discussion about the book. Once we have a few more pieces in place here, the one thing that it did gloss over, Chris, that I was kind of hoping that they would get into, there's that first and second page where they're talking, they have the construction workers who are hanging Moogly back up on the hook and ladder number 8 door, talking about these guys get parades. Why don't we get parades? Like, we do the same stuff they do. And then, you know, the bug comes out and scares the crap out of the guy and he falls out of the bucket and everything. That to me is like, I wanted more of that build up too. Like, I wanted to see the family in the car on the road trip, and because like that's just such a great family dynamic, especially with Gary in the mix now. I wanted to see more of that. But also, like, Winston had to buy the firehouse back, or did he own the fire? Like, all those questions that we've now had since Afterlife. Like, I thought that this was their golden opportunity to just something in there, like Winston's got to go in and sign the deed, or he's got to go double up on his offer because whoever the current tenant is won't move out. It's some artist who is squatting and refuses to leave. There was just one beat there that I really wanted, and maybe we'll get it in a flashback or something. But
hopefully, we'll just 3 more issues. They're building kind of an arc, a big bad, a mid-level big bad arc. It's pretty clear that we're not going to get into Egon at all, which, thing that kind of bugs me.
We're seeing them build up their family ghost busting technique, you know, so that when we get to the beginning of Frozen Empire, and it makes sense that they can take down the sewer dragon the way that they do. They all kind of figure out their roles and who does what and how the, you know.
I'm going to only point it out just to prove that A, my brain isn't completely mush, and so that Ryan Dole of the Ghostbusters British Columbia doesn't send me mocking text messages. Paul Grist did a bunch of comics. Kane, which was a British police detective procedural thing, and Jackstaff was the one I'm thinking of. But if you go look at that art, it is so I don't know what they call his style of art, but his is the earliest example I can think of in my head of a style that was very has been very popular in the last 10-15 years. Anyways, and actually they're great books too. So next time you're at the comic shop and you're bored, pick them up. But anyways, that was what I was trying to get to, was if you read his, you'll see what I mean. Like, for example, he'll do a lot of, this is the other thing too, is that his stuff is because you spend a lot more time, listening to the character conversations and the story and all that, because he hasn't, a lot of times he doesn't even do backgrounds. He does like a lot of white space behind, you know, the characters as they talk and stuff like this. Like, there's a lot of setup and then the rest of it is in your head while you just watch them talk and react and all that.
Just watch the talking.
I mean, we're going to touch on this series 3 more times, so we might as well not burn a whole episode. Did you want to dive back into
I think it provides a natural segue to something that I wanted to talk about last week that we didn't get to. So Back in Town also sets up Gary the fanboy, Gary the race dance, this is great stand-in, which, you know, when you watch... Because now, like, the Ghostbusters Afterlife was on FX, and I had to build some furniture last night, and I had it on, and was just, you know, it has become like my white noise. It's become like the comfort food that's in the background for me. And the one thing that I realized that I didn't quite make the connection between Afterlife and Frozen Empire was that Gary, in Afterlife, he's a seismologist. He is there studying the earthquake. Shout out to the New York earthquake that happened today.
Yeah.
But he's there studying these quakes. He's got his seismic maps. He's trying to triangulate. He is a scientist, and he is talking about the sine curves and the large S wave and all of these things that make him a scientist. He is an intellectual being who goes into the haunt box that the Spanglers inhabit, and he sees the maps and he's intrigued by them and he understands that it's cuneiform and all of this kind of stuff. I feel like we missed that a little bit in Frozen Empire. And again, I think it is a victim to just how much they were trying to do in the film that Gary just kind of comes off as like, he's a goofy Paul Rudd, you know, he's happy to be there, man. He's happy to be a Ghostbuster. He's a fan. We lose that he's a scientist, you know?
A bit, but again, it came down to, in 2 hours, you can fit X number of beats, story beats.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to let some go. And we talked about it last time. Trevor's got downplayed quite a bit in the... and all the more reason to go read the comic, because it's pretty clear that we're going to get a lot more time with all the members. Because a 4-issue comic arc gives you a lot of time to... Like, the whole thing about Trevor is now a bit of a social outcast, too, because Lucky is a year ahead of him, and she's moved on. You know, he doesn't know that she's come to New York yet, and he can't get a hold of her because she's off doing, you know, 1 year older and done a school thing. And he's got 1 year left, and new town, new school, last year school, that sucks. And the one thing he's great at is... automotives, and shop doesn't do that in New York, which is kind of weird actually when I think about it, But yeah, they worry about other stuff.
Computers.
So,
yeah.
But Trevor's character got, what's a way to put it? Necessarily, but unfortunately depreciated.
Yeah, it's very truncated
in the movie.
Yeah,
Gary, same thing. But it comes down to balancing what beats. So that's the interesting thing, is to look at the movie and what they did do and why those beats were chosen over the stuff that you wish they'd done more.
Yeah,
and the reality is, it'd be nice to like do a lot more Gary as the Ghostbuster geek fan who's now a Ghostbuster, and you know his science background shines a bit more. But at the end of the day, he's got to talk to an empty room about how much he wants to support Phoebe and all that sort of thing, and he's kind of getting into the dad role and all that. That beat kind of trumps it. We saw it in the last movie. We know he's a scientist. We know he's a fan.
Yeah, exactly.
Why hit it again when we need the time to let him warm up to being a dad?
Yeah, you're, and that is like he is trying to. That's what makes the fulfilling thing at the end, where she calls him dad, and he has that yes reaction that I love so much, because his story, that is his arc. You know, he just wants to be dad, and he's trying to figure out how he officially fits into this. And of course, there's that whole amazing like the sequence between he and Callie, like the way that Carrie Coon and Paul Rudd play it, that like, Paul Rudd can't be the bad guy. He can't be the disciplinarian who goes to the kids and says, you know, go to your room. You know, like you can't take him seriously. And that whole dynamic works just so well. But I also feel like it, and maybe in future films, like then we'll have that sort of like, you know, he can dive in, get his hands a little bit dirty. Because the same thing, like you wanted that scene that has been in the TV spots with he and Venkman, getting advice, but I wanted more with he and Ray, like, because I feel like the two of them have such a kinship. They have such a sort of common bond for their enthusiasm, their love of things, their thirst for knowledge. And what little you got out of Dan Aykroyd of the Rayisms, you know, when he got super excited about something and he had that like energy again, like I can imagine the two of them amplifying that, and that would have just been so much fun to see and explore. Absolutely. So, and there's still time.
If you want to give yourself a little exercise, sit down and so especially the people who think that, oh, the movie sucks because they didn't do this, and what, you know, they're idiots because they didn't do that. It's like, sit down and think of a character and then write the beats and that form a connection. Some of them may be weaker than others, but at the end of the day, you'll end up with, really, it's certain side characters that, and the thing is, side characters, all bets are off.
Yeah.
Side characters kind of just show up sometimes and then kind of go. So James Acaster, can't wait to see more of him in the future, because as was pointed out, he kind of like runs into Pukey and then he's gone for the rest of the movie.
I got a lot of responses to that last week, by the way. Yeah. Like, I know he shows up. I know he's there and he does his did we win thing, but he vanishes. And he
disappears.
AJ, I think I want to give credit to AJ. It's like, okay, so he gets puked on and then he's near a huge explosion when the containment unit blows up. Maybe that was enough of a concussive thing to knock him down or knock him out or whatever. But
sure, here's the thing. He's not a main character.
I know, and I still stand by. I want one, like, Gil, just give me, like, it needs to be, like, 48 frames of him after being puked on just saying, like, this isn't worth it. I don't get paid enough. Done.
Right. Or any sort of reaction. Fair's fair. Fair's fair. He should have been, as much as it was cute. And they did say, because there was an article somewhere about the guy who played the truck driver in the mid-credit sequence.
Oh,
they interviewed him and stuff like that.
He did a video something of like his experience, or I haven't been able to watch it yet.
Apparently Gil and them, the whole idea of the mini puffs and all that is supposed to tie into something later on. I'm like, that they're the paranormal rats of the universe, because I'm still on board for that. But in fairness, James's character should have been, that's where he should have had his thing, right? It should have been in the mid-credit sequence. We should have gone back to him, or back to him and Peck or something. Like the people who had a point and a purpose in the middle of the movie, like but really no room for an arc. And rather than just sort of they walk, I mean, hell, even Peck got his ultimate thing was is that he got cornered and had to applaud the Ghostbusters and give them the go ahead to move forward. Not a great one, but so what? It's Peck. Who cares?
Oh, but that screw line you, of Peck. Dialogue, that ADR line of like, just give him support, dickless, or whatever the guy says. I wish I knew that line now by heart. It gets me every time.
It was so good.
Laughed. The second time I was in the theater and it was myself and a couple of families, and I don't think the other families caught it, or maybe, you know, they didn't, you know, get the reference or whatever, but I audibly guffawed and nobody else did. And I was like, that's fine. Well, I'm not embarrassed.
That's fine. Cool. But finish my thought. If you plot the arcs, everybody kind of has one, and depending on which one that Gil and Jason thought was more important, like that's the thing, you can see them. So if they don't have room to give everybody super big ones, Phoebe had the super big one.
Yeah.
Right? And then a step down, let's be honest, it's Gary. Gary had the second biggest.
Yeah. Ray, I would argue Ray has maybe the second.
Ray has the third.
Biggest. Yeah.
Yep. Then Callie, I think.
Yeah.
Let's just walk down the list there. No, I would, to be honest, I would actually move Callie down one more, and I would put Firemaster in there.
Oh, yeah, Nadim. Yeah.
Nadim would have a slightly bigger one than, because remember, Callie's whole one is being a parent's hard. And yeah, her beats are there, but mostly she's there to push the Gary arc, sort of thing.
Well, she has an arc too. You know, her arc is that
they all do.
Yeah, my point is that she's a Ghostbuster, but she's not good at it.
No, you know? My point is if you mark them from the start of the movie to the end, they all have little ones.
Yeah,
Trevor, and they kind of set them up like right out the gate, right? Like that first scene. That's kind of the beauty of the first scene. Given how hectic things are going to be, it sets up a lot of the main stories. Trevor now wants to be regarded as an adult and drive the car. And they're like, and so later on, what's the beat? She's like, you're an adult. Go deal with the problem yourself. So he does the Slimer thing. And then at the end of the movie, gets to drive the car. Is it a really intricate arc? Nope. But it's there. And he had his little story.
One step further, if he would have gotten a paycheck, if they would have thrown him the keys and like start paperwork, like.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because he was bitching about not getting paid, remember?
Would you please fill out this W-8 Ben here for your for your taxes? But yeah, Phoebe's right out the gate, Gary, Callie. The main four characters, their arcs, even though some of them are bigger and more involved than others, were all set up in that first scene.
Yeah.
And they all wrapped up at the end of the movie. And with people complaining, oh, they sucked and they did it wrong. Nope. They did exactly what you're supposed to. The main characters had their thing. We're grading them too hard on things like, why didn't they do more with the originals and all that? It's like, because that's not where things are going. The thing's not about the originals anymore. You and I talked about this last time, right?
And they're used to great effect. I mean, I think we mentioned it last week, but I've seen some especially on GB fans and the Reddit threads, some back and forth on that scene between Winston and Ray after everything goes down at the New York Public Library. You know, Winston telling Ray, like, you can't be in the Ecto-1 chasing the ghosts anymore. You can't be out in the field. You put the kids in danger. You could have gotten yourself hurt. You could have gotten them hurt. And you and I both pointed to, like, I like that scene. I enjoy, like, because that is them talking about quite literally what's going on behind the scenes too. Like the two of them cannot be in every movie with the proton packs at the final climax of the film fighting the bad guys.
Yeah.
I mean, Ernie will be there until the dude turns 120, as good for him. He was trending online this past week for being his age and looking as good as he does. But that is art imitating life, for the two of them. And I've seen some people that really, they bristled on that, because they didn't think that Winston would be that harsh on Ray. You know, that Winston wouldn't have dug in as deeply as he did. and then B, that they didn't think that it rang true to either of the characters. People are different. People change. It's that same, like in Afterlife, when Ray says that Egon Spengler can rot in hell, you wouldn't picture it. Frank Welker in Real Ghostbusters would never say those words, because that character in Real Ghostbusters is just so, aw, shucks, gosh, wholesome, and so yeah. glad to be there. But people do change. People, especially when you get older, your viewpoints change. That's why we have such a tough time with older politicians, because their priorities are a little different than my priorities. But I think that was just a wonderful encompassment of what these two characters are having to deal with on screen and off screen. And then when you get to the end and they're all like, you know, all for one and trying to get the containment unit, handled down to shut the grid, And there's that joke about golden years, you know?
Yeah.
That arc right there, even if it is just a small thing, just a little, like, Phoebe's dealing with being sidelined and benched, and Ray is dealing with being older and being quote-unquote retired and benched.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And so the two of them see that and find a kinship there. Like that stuff just really works to me. And yes, if the movie had just like 20 or 30 minutes just to let that moment breathe one more second, I feel like it would have been better affected, but,
what can you do?
Yeah. What can you do? And then the original, like,
I think,
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the originals stick to their characters fine. I mean, you're trying to argue that people change. And I was like, yeah, although I think at the root, they're all still exactly the same, right?
Yeah.
People forget that Winston was hired purely pragmatic financial reasons. He was like, it's a job, I can do it. And he grew to love it by the end of the, you know, the first and the second movie, which means it explains why as he becomes more successful later, and since he knows ghosts are real, and again, very pragmatic, recognizes that there's a big question mark that could be dangerous, takes steps to keep the Ghostbusters going and all that sort of thing. But that's not the same thing as pow, pow, let's go running around with the proton packs anymore. Ray was always 100% the guy running around with the video recorder going, I need another tape. I need another tape. Right? Like there's just, this was another exactly thing. He's just excited by the idea of getting out there and seeing what's going on and all that.
Yeah.
And you can expand that out all the way over to Venkman. Venkman has always been able to take it or leave it. He's happy to help his friends, and he shows up when they need him, but he's not 100% necessarily on board. And right? Even Janine, like, what's whole Janine's whole thing? Is like, I've quit better jobs than this. And it's like, well, why haven't you
quit?
And it's the same thing here. It's like, it's been 40 years. Why are you still here? Like, she has some weirdly sarcastic thread about, well, somebody's got to take care of some stuff. And that's been her whole role. Like, she is this, when Winston can't be there, she's been acting as this intermediary for taking care of stuff from the comic to the movie, to the last movie. She's take care of loose ends, which was basically what she was doing in the movie. She's she's the administrative heart of the Ghostbusters operations. So
yeah, taking care of the stuff that the other guys don't even think about.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think they're all exactly the same. I think everything that we saw with them fits the characters just fine.
Yeah.
It's just those same characters where 40 years have passed and certain realities have started to sink in for some and not others. And they got to find the new norm sort of thing. And like I said, they're setting it up that in the movies going forward, we'll see that those things played out exactly the same.
Yeah.
Ray's going to be Grandpa Ray, who's enthused but can't run around with them anymore. And Winston's the reason why everything's still running. And Janine's going to stick her head in when, you know, somebody needs to, like, sort a mess out. And if Bill Murray ever finds something funny, he'll... they'll lure him back to pop his head, and that's
you
it.
You want to throw a pen at Kumail Nanjiani? Heck yes, I am there.
Moving forward, it's about the family, and to a lesser degree, you know, the tribe they're building, right? Podcast and Lucky, and all the other side characters that are now presumably going to show up in the future movies.
Yeah,
because
I hope they do. I hope, like, all the new entries, I hope that they do show up in future movies. I hope that we see more of James Acaster and Kumail Nanjiani and Patton Oswalt. And, you know, I think that's their goal too. I think they really want to infuse those characters into the future, just in the same way that Louis Tully shows up in Ghostbusters 2. Like, you know, when you need an expert witness, when somebody on the stand, there's Hubert, you know, there he is.
I think it's important that people, sorry, kids, we don't want to see the originals too much more. Otherwise it's going to turn into like Ernest Borgnine in Red, where it's like, it's super cool to see Ernest Borgnine. But boy, he's very, very old.
You feel bad. You feel sad.
The best they do is he sits and stands up and shakes a hand and says a couple of lines. And it's like, that was nice, but that's kind of sad. It's like, if you really want to hold on to your what Ghostbusters is in your head, make peace with the adjustments they're making now and where it's going to end up in the next movie. Because if you're in your head, it's like, I want to see them all bust ghosts one more time. It was like, I don't know we're going to get that, guys. Like, you're going to have to dial your head back to Ghostbusters 2 from now on, because it's I don't need a 90-year-old Bill Murray barely able to, I don't need a Bob Hope like that well past his prime but still being kicked out to entertain us, right?
Like, I don't want to see that for them. No, for me, for everybody.
I don't want them to. So, yeah.
I think they're setting it up nicely. And I think with Winston being this beneficiary or the financer of everything, I think that also sets things up to, because Winston has his own motives, his own goals, his own, as we see in this movie, like he's doing stuff with the engineering team and he has his own paranormal research institute that Gary and Callie and everybody don't even know about yet. And I know that was sort of a sticking point for some people too. Like, how come they don't know? Well, maybe they didn't need to know. Maybe, you know, they were trying to get the firehouse back up and running. They were on the island, you know, busting ghosts and doing what they do. And, you know, Winston maybe didn't need to bring them into the fray of that kind of stuff yet. Maybe it wasn't ready yet. Maybe it was on a need to know basis. I don't know. I think that sets up some fun and interesting things too, that, you know, there are questions. I would point out that
we might even get a little taste of this in the last couple of issues of the comic series.
Because
there is a lot of room in that comic series for somebody to go, wait, you're letting them live in the firehouse? What about X, Y, and Z? And he goes, you know, they'll know when they got to know, but in the meantime, shadowy purpose. And then we go into Frozen Empire and things make a little more sense.
We need somebody on that front line, and I just need them to stay focused and whatever. I need them to whatever. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So, but anyway, so I want to, we're getting close on time, and I want to make sure that we get to a couple of your voicemails because we still have some in the can from last week. And so here's some of your voicemails, and then we'll launch into our final thoughts here.
Hey, Troy, Peter Berg calling. Just wanted to say I enjoyed your solo review of Frozen Empire. It's nice to hear your thoughts and how it was an honest review of the film. I wouldn't say you sugarcoated it, so you gave it straight as the movie was. I just got out of the movie. I'd say it was good. I had quite a few issues with the format and the kind of the structure, but it's a lot to make a great Ghostbusters movie as we know, but felt like it was a blend of Ghostbusters 2 and Afterlife kind of together, but not my favorite, but still had some nice moments in it. Look forward to hearing more of your thoughts in the later episodes, but appreciate the content, hope you're doing well, and go Ghostbusters. So have a good one. Thanks, man. Bye.
Hey Chris, hey Troy, it's Trevor over from over the pond from the Welsh Ghostbusters. It's a very quick call just to say, loved your overview of Frozen Empire and looking forward to the next episode. It was interesting going in watching Frozen Empire. I found on the first watch, it's a lot to take in, especially as a long-time Ghostbusters fan. But then when I went to watch it in a much smaller cinema, the second time around, I completely loved it. I completely kind of got where they were going with it, kind of the evolution, and kind of if you actually break it down and listening to Troy's last cast when he did 30 minutes talking, touching on little bits, and then actually listening to the Yes House and kind of breaking down little bits without going too spoilery, it kind of opens up some of the like things that you see before watching it that second, third, fourth, possibly tenth time, which I've seen a couple of people have already done. So it's just kind of action-packed. It's very much like the real Ghostbusters. And I think a lot of us, like my age, nearly coming 40, don't actually realise is that we probably didn't see Ghostbusters when it first came out in the cinema. Probably didn't actually see Ghostbusters 2 when it first came out in the cinema. But we were brought into kind of that Ghostbusters environment by the real Ghostbusters and kind of following it from there. And then when we go back to the films, we kind of almost, our memory is kind of thinking, well, oh, Ghostbusters, the first film and the second film, are the main things that we kind of brought onto. So it's kind of inspired us to do quite a few more things, and it's almost set a really nice platform for Ghostbusters to expand out, possibly internationally, hopefully Wales, Scotland, you never know. Really enjoyed it. I've also really enjoyed the behind-the-scenes stuff as well. It was filmed in the UK, so it's been excellent to watch how a lot of things are built and how they kind of used a lot of like local UK people to kind of develop it out that way as well, which has been brilliant. It puts, when we look back at it now, where we were as a fan back in that court sort of like 97 on to say even like 2009 when the video game came out, and as a big fan talking about Ghostbusters, it was tumbleweeds every time you spoke about it. Now we're in a real positive kind of full period where Ghostbusters, people are saying, oh, I never saw the original, but now I've taken my kids to go and see Frozen Empire, and we've watched Afterlife because it was on the BBC, and we've gone back and watched the other films, and it's put it kind of back into the front, and it's great for the 40th anniversary, really, to be bringing that to the level, really. And it's made us really busy at the Welsh Ghostbusters, so we've got a busy 12 months coming up with lots of props being built and lots of shows as well. But great having you guys back on the air. We have missed you.
Professionals.
We want to hear from you. Leave us a voicemail on our call-in line at 470-242-4742. That's 4702-GBHQIC. We also have a Facebook page.
You do?
And Twitter accounts.
Fence is dead.
No kidding. Just give me the address.
Search Facebook for
the Ghostbusters Interdimensional Crossrip.
On Twitter, look for Troy at Ghostbusters HQ and Chris at Proton Jar Jar.
What the hell are you doing?
If you like what you hear, please take a moment to give us a review on iTunes. Be sure to recommend us to your friends.
That makes good sense. Don't wait another minute. Pick up your phone and call the professionals.
Once again, our call-in line is 4702-GBHQIC.
That'll do it. Thanks very much, Ray.
Well, clearly, Chris, there will be a part 3.
Yes.
I feel like we didn't even scratch the surface again. What the?
We haven't talked about the music.
No.
And I know you love talking about the music.
Oh, my God. I could talk ad nauseum about the music.
We got the cinematography article. It's been a good week for you because that article dove right.
It's so great.
That article named cameras. Lenses, all your favorites.
That's what I live for. That is my bread and butter. Yeah, you're right. And the other thing too about the music that we need to talk about is the lack of some particular music, because this is like it's a huge step for a Ghostbusters film to not have more than two pop. I mean, I've arguably one pop track on the entire film.
Yeah, not
soundtrack.
A single one.
So we'll have to talk about that too. Yeah, there's much, much, much. Maybe that's what we have to do. Maybe we need to just break our discussion points into topics, and then we'll
finally
get to
that
point.
Well, because I don't know what else we need really. Well, that's not true. I think next time when you and I can wander for a bit more than an hour, we'll dive back into like the second half of the movie because we didn't dial in on the second half of the movie much yet.
We have to talk about the weird
part,
magic.
The weird part
to,
is
there's magic in this world. We have to. This is like
the weird. Yeah, the weird part is this. You and I did 2 hours talking about the first half, going, "Wow, we got lots to talk about." We'll get to the second half of the movie later. We spent the last hour revisiting the first half of the movie.
But that's what makes these so good, though, Chris. Like
I enjoy it.
The multiple viewings, the multiple conversations, the things that you see and absorb on different iterations of it. Like that's, I stand by my claim that like Frozen Empire and Ghostbusters movies in general are like albums. Like when you buy that album and you tear off the cellophane and you throw it into your tape deck and you listen to it the first time, you're like, that's all right. And then you listen to it a second time, like, oh, I dig what they did there. And then you listen to it a third time and you realize that it's this cohesive, like, concept album that you had no idea. And you're like, oh my God, this is brilliant.
Yeah.
You need that repetition and that time to absorb and analyze.
The equipment and the fire hall in this movie alone make it very, very clear that they have thought a lot about making this movie. Whether you agree with decisions or understand the decisions or not, they put a lot of thought into it, which means we can revisit this movie just as much as we revisited all the previous movies. Because when a movie's made with a lot of love and attention to detail, we can spend decades diving further and further and multiple viewings to find the stuff in there.
Yeah, and that's not to say, like, look, we played a voicemail last week. Somebody who didn't like it, like, it's okay if you didn't like it. Like, that's totally fine. We're not telling you,
we're not forcing you to.
If you didn't like it, your opinion's not valid. Like, it's fine. If it's not your cup of tea, I totally get it.
I hope you're listening to our episode and that what we say encourages you to revisit the movie the next time you watch it and kind of keep those things in mind. But, you know, if I don't change your mind, so what? You do you. That's fine. I'm not.
And maybe the next one will get you. Hopefully, the next film, fingers crossed, will get you.
But like you said, that album thing's there. For all you know, some of the people who hated it, they're going to have to watch it 3 or 4 more times, and then something will just click. Just like albums, where you're like, I didn't like that album. And then 4 listenings in, you're like, oh, I kind of get it now.
And how it affects, like, when you've now seen Frozen Empire a couple of times and you go back and watch Afterlife, it changes Afterlife a little bit. Like, the way that you perceive Afterlife is a little bit different, too. But anyway, what do you got in terms of final thoughts, my friend?
The golden age of movie prop buying is over. Strange Tales that Ray reads. Did you see the listing on Amazon?
It's like $300 or something now?
No,
or?
It was $600.
Oh, jeez.
So it's not in print anymore, but Amazon will still sell books used, which means you go to find the used people. And you can tell that they saw Ray reading it, and it's got the floppy cover, because the hardcover, I tried to buy it, but the listing is old. Amazon doesn't always update the sales properly. Yeah. So somebody must have the same thought I did, which was, for $14, I'll take that hardcover. Thank you very much. That's fine. I'm curious to read it. The soft cover was listing as high as $600.
Jeez.
And people, now that said, Paul Gannon at there in the UK, who's also a paranormal fan, his book's almost done. Sorry, that'll be my final thought next week. But Paul is a love of the paranormal, even more so than I do. I have a passing interest in the paranormal. I've never, he goes on ghost hunts and all that. But anyways, he had that. He has it. He has a copy, to which I joked, hey, you're a millionaire. And he checked eBay. And for the moment, the eBay people haven't figured it out, because you can still occasionally find a copy for
a normal price,
a reasonable $20 or whatever sort of thing. But I don't think that'll last long. It'll be sort of like the New York World's Fair coins. Once people figure those out. Their price kind of skyrocketed after that.
The Seiko voice note watches, where it's like those were already rare watches, and now that everybody knows that they're the Ghostbusters watch, like that just drives it up too. Yeah.
I own shoe polishers and gas sniffers. You know what? My final thought's not that. I want to leave it on a positive note. I need to get my hands on a copy of the movie as quickly as I can because I need to start doing comparisons. I think the basement's a bit bigger than it was in the original.
I think you're right.
It feels like they, for practicality purposes, they made it. It looks like it's about 2 feet wider or something like that.
Well, because there's the laundry machines down in the basement now too, where I think that wall was just like in the original film. That wall had those like industrial shelves on it that had like the traps and a couple of things on it, but it was very narrow because that was like the original. That was the
stick.
The ladder 23 basement.
Stick a pin in it because. This will be fun to get into because there's a couple of things. One, it was a replica, which meant they had room to build it out. They weren't constrained by the real fire hall. Did they do it in the real fire hall? Yeah, the one in L.A.
Which we found out that they actually had to reduce the size on the set. Because did you see any of that? Like the White Lock design stuff? Oh, that's another topic for another.
Okay, then we totally got to get into it. Yeah. That's the one thing that popped out at me is like so many viewings, nothing really stood out to me as their replica it was weird or off or anything like that. Except for that one basement, it felt like they made it a bit bigger.
It has blown up twice now. I mean, you're just the demo work is doing itself down there.
Although the other weird thing too is the suggestion that the whole thing was much bigger. And then Egon built an insane machine and then bricked it up. So by design of the... And then you get into the weirdness of which means that because of where the stairs are and how they go... No, that still goes in. Oh, God. See, this is what... Another episode.
Yeah.
I have to doodle some charts. I gotta get the graph paper out.
How big does the containment unit go back into the wall? And there's some things there that you have to kind of figure out.
Boy, anyway, that's my final thought. Another good excuse for people to call in.
Yes.
And tell us about your thoughts about the replica of the fire hall and things you noticed and didn't notice and all that. Share them with us.
Yeah,
because we're not done talking about it. So
absolutely, that's for sure. So yeah, call in, use that voicemail. Absolutely send us messages the way that you have been. I am so thankful and ecstatic that everybody is listening to us still and writing in and giving us your thoughts. And as you respond to things, we're getting your DMs and your tweets and everything. And we really appreciate it. So until next week, where we'll talk part 3. Plus maybe some music, plus maybe some magic, plus maybe some geographic locations of the firehouse stuff.
3/??
We'll see you on the other side, everybody. Who you gonna call?
We got her! Thanks for joining the Ghostbusters Interdimensional Crossrip. Visit us at protoncharging.com, GhostbustersHQ.net, and StillPlayingWithToys.net.
That used to be one of my 2 favorite shows.
Everything you're doing is bad. I just want to let you know that.
Really found its voice in the 46th episode.
Next week, though, Careless Pets. We're so cool.